On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Environmental Molecular Diagnostics, New Tools for Better Decisions. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to cover some information on a few introductory slides and then quickly turn our presentation over to our trainers from the ITRC Environmental Molecular Diagnostics team. Today's training course is based on the ITRC Technical and Regulatory Guidance document. We're going to introduce you to this guidance during today's training class, and we do encourage you to use the guidance after today's training. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. A few housekeeping items to cover before we get started. We are scheduled for 2.25 hours. We are recording today's session. The trainers are going to control the slides on Adobe Connect today. If you'd want to control your own slides, you can use the related link and go to the CLUIN training page. So select CLUIN training page, look down a bit, select browse to. That's going to allow you to open that link. And at the top of the page, there's the option for you to download the presentation. We do look forward to your questions and feedback throughout today's training class. In the lower right, we have a Q&A pod. You can send in questions or comments anytime. We will have a question and answer breaks in the middle and at the end of the presentation, and we will ask some of those questions out loud. At the end of the class, we do ask that you complete our feedback form. We really do use the information that you provide. It's also an option that allows you to create a certificate of participation for your attendance today. So again, through the feedback form, fill out the form, check the box at the bottom to certify you attended, and our system will create a certificate for you. Right now, the only way to get that is through the feedback form. So if you forget to check the box, just go back and check the box again. More information about ITRC is available on the website. ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators. It includes our federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. The full version of the ITRC disclaimer is in the notes section of this slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted. You can learn more about ITRC on the website, and I do encourage you to visit the website to see what technical and regulatory guidance are available. Soon we'll have our schedule for next year available, and there's new teams that you may be interested in so you can become more involved in ITRC. I'll introduce our trainers for today's class. All trainers are members of the ITRC Environmental Molecular Diagnostics team. That team was led by Bob Mueller of the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. Jennifer Wiedes is an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at University of Utah. She directed a molecular biology laboratory which routinely analyzed groundwater, soil, and sediment samples by various EMD methods for microorganisms involved in contaminant bioremediation. Paul Hatzinger is a senior scientist working with CERTIP in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. His current areas of research focus on the development of in situ and ex situ bioremediation technologies for emerging contaminants and the use of stable isotope methods to distinguish contaminant sources and to document contaminant biodegradation. James Fish is an environmental program specialist with the Contaminated Sites Program of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation in Fairbanks. He oversees the characterization and remediation of contaminated sites across Alaska's interior. Aaron Peacock was an environmental scientist at Haley and Aldrich in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Since 1995, he has worked both in academia and industry, specializing in biotechnology and environmental molecular diagnostics. On slide 6, I'll turn the presentation over to Jennifer Wiedes at University of Utah. Jennifer?
Thank you, Juliana. On behalf of the Environmental Molecular Diagnostics team, I'd like to welcome the audience to today's training. I'm actually excited about today's training. I think we have some really great tools that most of our audience are going to find useful for improving their remediation decision making at their sites. So we're starting on slide 6. And we see here an outline of today's training topics. You're going to hear from me for the first 10 or 15 minutes where I'm going to give you an overview to EMDs and what we mean by environmental molecular diagnostics. And then you'll hear from Paul, where he'll talk about one of the commonly used techniques CSIA, which stands for Compound Specific Isotope Analysis, and then he's going to link the theory immediately with some case studies to try to help our audience understand how does the particular science behind that technique tie to how you can answer questions at your site. Then we're going to hear from Jim, where he'll talk about qPCR, which stands for Quantitative Polymerase Chain Reaction. And yes, you will hear a lot of acronyms today. I'll point out later on we have a slide, which might be useful for you guys to keep next to you as we go through this acronym soup today. But as Jim talks about qPCR, he's also going to link the theory with some case studies. And then after our 10-minute break, we'll hear from Jim again. He will talk about some other biological EMD tools, which are just as powerful as qPCR, but answer different questions and need to be selected and used carefully. And then finally, we'll hear from Aaron, who he will talk about some case studies where actual multiple EMDs were used to try to answer some very specific questions at a site. And then you'll hear from me in the last 10 minutes of the training again, where I'll walk you through the web-based TechFreg document to try to answer some other questions that we didn't get to in today's training. So when we talk about EMDs, one of the major questions that people have are, how can these EMDs help me at my site? So on slide 7, we have presented you with a series of what-if questions that you might have at your site. So for example, what if you could use EMDs to support monitored natural attenuation decision-making by showing that your contaminants are actually being biologically degraded at your site rather than just being decreased through dilution? In some instances, you can actually use some of these tools to help you determine a degradation rate, or in other tools could be used to maybe target your groundwater sampling to reduce the size of your monitoring network and thus save you cost at a site. Another question you might have is, what are these EMDs that we're actually going to be presenting today? So we see here on slide 8 that these techniques actually fall into one of two categories, those being chemical techniques, such as compound-specific isotope analysis that you'll hear about first today, and the other type of techniques being biologically based or molecular biological techniques that you may have heard of before. We group those two types of categories under the EMDs, or environmental molecular diagnostics, and these tools really are an additional tool in your toolbox to help you analyze soil, sediment, groundwater samples, any environmental sample really, to help you determine, is biodegradation occurring, is chemical degradation occurring, and various other questions that really you can't tease out with traditional groundwater monitoring for a particular contaminant concentration. Or you can't answer that question in a short period of time, whereas maybe these EMDs can help you get that final piece of evidence that you need to make your decision making. A lot of these molecular or biological tools actually have been around for decades. They've been used originally in medical applications, and we have more recently adapted them for environmental site management. I say recently, but actually they've been used for maybe 20 years in the field. So to show you how these tools might be used at your site, we're going to present a hypothetical case study here on slide 9. And so in this hypothetical case study, let's assume that you've got BTEX or gasoline contamination of your groundwater, and one of the questions you want to answer is, are microorganisms actually degrading the BTEX at the site? And you have not only an aerobic portion of your plume, but you also have an anaerobic portion of your plume, and you want to determine how much biological degradation is occurring for those gasoline constituents. Well, you can use EMDs such as qPCR, as Jim will talk about, or a variation on that technique, which is called RT-qPCR, to actually determine if the microorganisms are present at the site and if they're actually turning on the enzymes that we know that are associated with gasoline degradation. Further, you can also couple this with compound-specific isotope analysis to have another piece of evidence showing that there's actually isotopic enrichment of those gasoline constituents. And Jim and Paul will go into these techniques more as you hear about them in a couple minutes. So really these techniques, these EMDs, allow you to make more informed selection of remedy decisions at your site in a timely manner. And really they're an additional tool in your toolbox. You will still have to go at your site and measure groundwater contamination, benzene concentrations, for example, in the vapor or in the groundwater, but you can answer pretty quickly, is biodegradation actually occurring at my site, or is it chemical degradation? Whereas you might have to collect multiple months or even years of traditional data to answer that same question. So let's assume that you conduct this analysis on your hypothetical site, and then you convince yourself that biodegradation is actually occurring, and you want to go to your regulators, and you want to get them to buy in on whatever your remedial approach is. And one of your questions might be, hey, how familiar are my regulators with these particular EMD techniques? So we went out as part of this ITRC team and surveyed regulators from 29 different states, and we asked them this question. Have you used EMDs? How much do you know about them? Or has your buddy in the cubicle next door used EMDs? And so fully a third of our regulators at that time when we did the survey said they did know about EMDs, but two-thirds of them said, no, we don't know anything about EMDs, but they all acknowledged that these techniques might be very valuable for making decisions at your site. But they did have some concern about how you might implement these techniques at a site to make sure that the data you got was valuable for making decisions. And so the regulatory feedback and our own team's experiences actually drove the training that you're hearing today and our online technical regulatory guidance document. And you see that our team is actually pretty diverse. We have folks from academia such as myself, but also quite a few folks in the private sector who have actually used these techniques, and in some cases they're actually vendors or commercial labs that do these analyses for folks. And then of course we had several state and federal regulators as well as folks from DOD, DOE, and EPA. So these survey results and our team's expertise led to our training objective today, which you see on slide 11. And what we want you folks to walk away from this training today is an ability to be able to describe when these EMDs can be used for site management, and when is it most appropriate to use these techniques to augment the traditional data that you're going to have to collect. And then at the end of the training, I want to give you just a quick survey of when and how to utilize that EMD document, because we have a whole bunch of information up there, and we don't want information overload for you. So how do you quickly find the information that's most useful to you? And these objectives really can be thought of also as a series of questions, if you will. What we want you to be able to answer at the end of this training is, what are EMDs, how are they going to help me, and more importantly, how do I select an EMD? Because Jim later on is going to present you another 7 or 8 different techniques that you might be able to choose from to answer questions. So it can be confusing. We're going to try to walk you through that. So in trying to answer, you know, how EMDs can help me and what benefits do they provide, on slide 13, we present you a series of questions that you might have at your particular site as you move through this environmental remediation process. So for example, during site characterization, one of your questions might be, are there multiple sources contributing to the pollution at my site? Compound-specific isotope analysis, as Paul will talk about, is a very powerful tool to answer that question. You might also want to know, hey, is biological degradation occurring, or is it abiotic degradation occurring at my site? And many of the EMDs we'll present today will answer that question. Or maybe you spend a whole bunch of money to put a bioaugmentation culture down your wells, and you want to know, how far do the microorganisms spread? Are they still active? Are they doing what I put them in there to do? And EMDs, in particular qPCR, can be a powerful tool to answer that question. As we see on slide 14, what we want to emphasize today is that these EMDs can really provide you information that traditional methods may not be able to. So traditional methods being several rounds of soil or sediment or groundwater sampling. So for example, they can tell you, is the particular microorganism that I know is linked to TCE and TCE or trichloroethylene complete dechlorination present at my site? One organism that we know is linked to complete TCE degradation of ethene is Dehalicocoides mccardii. With qPCR, you can say, is that organism present at my site? And more importantly, are the genes that are associated with complete TCE degradation present? And we'll have a couple of case studies later on where we present how you can use qPCR to answer that question. So again, you're getting direct evidence of contaminant biodegradation, and it provides sort of a missing piece of information. Now, you're still going to have to do your site characterization. You may have to do some groundwater monitoring or soil monitoring, but you may be able to reduce the amount of other types of sampling you'll have to do. So which EMDs really are valuable for supporting environmental decision making? And you know, how do we really classify these different techniques we're going to be talking about today and in the guidance document? On the left-hand side of slide 15, we see that microorganisms, like us, make a living by doing the same things as we do as humans, right? They have to eat or get food from somewhere. They have to breathe or respire. They have to get rid of their waste and reproduce and adapt to their environment. Cells, like humans, use enzymes to do all of those processes up above. And what we have developed or adopted from other science, basically, is mechanisms to test not only for the microorganism, but actual tests to see if that enzyme is being produced. Some of those tools are listed on the right-hand side of slide 15, and we've grouped these into molecular biological techniques on the top right and chemical techniques on the lower right. The two that you're going to hear the most about today, which are the most commercially available to date, include qPCR, a quantitative polymerase chain reaction, and CSA, or compound-specific isotope analysis. And as I mentioned before, this is a slide that might be useful to you as we go through all this acronym soup, unfortunately, in our training today. Okay, so at this point, you may wonder, hey, under what conditions might these EMDs work for my site? What particular contaminants can I target? What geochemical conditions are they useful for? So we see on slide 16 that EMDs are actually applicable for a wide variety of contaminants. We have techniques, qPCR or CSIA methods, to help us tease out information about pesticides or explosives or chlorinated solvents or petroleum hydrocarbons. These techniques can be applied for a variety of environmental samples, whether that's water or sediment, or sometimes soil gases. It can be under aerobic or anaerobic conditions. And really, we're trying to tease out questions that would take you much longer to answer with traditional monitoring, or may never be answered with traditional monitoring. So are microorganisms present? How active are they? Is it biological or chemical degradation that's occurring? Where have these techniques actually been used, right? We've said that they've been used for a lot of contaminants and seemingly every type of environmental sample you can come up with. And so we surveyed the people on our ITRC team, and this data was compiled from 2009 to 2012 from two of the vendors that were on our ITRC team. And what we see here depicted on the map of the United States is the number of projects per state that those vendors reported they had analyzed samples for clients. Now, for instance, in California, where there's more than 200 projects, that doesn't mean like one particular site where there were 200 samples that were sent in. This means there were thousands and thousands of samples that were analyzed in that particular state, again, in that three-year period, and I'm sure these numbers have significantly increased since we took the survey. But you'll see that across the nation they've been applied, and I think that sort of reflects the fact that a third of our state regulators are actually familiar with these techniques or have heard about them. And what we want to do is increase the level of understanding in the rest of those states and for the rest of those two-thirds of regulatory folks to make sure that they're using these really valuable tools. And so some, but certainly not all of these projects that you see across the United States were used to help support monitored natural attenuation. So we see here on slide 18 that there were actually two recent guidance documents where they call out the use of these molecular biological tools or EMDs or CSIA specifically to help support M&A. So if you're interested, you can go look at these two publications from the National Academies and from the Air Force Civil Engineering Center. And actually, those two guidance documents said we need more of these tools because they are so powerful, in particular for answering questions of these really complex contaminated sites. Okay, so on slide 19, we also answer one question we commonly get about EMDs. How much do they cost, and how commercially available are they? Now, again, this information was compiled up to 2012, and you're going to see a pretty broad range for some of these costs. On the top portion of this table, we have listed what we consider to be widely commercially available methods, those being qPCR and CSIA, meaning there's a handful of labs that are available that you could send your samples to that can analyze for these particular methods. Now, there are also some academic labs that will do these tests for you, as well as federal facility labs, but there are fewer commercial labs. For instance, for the minimally commercially available on the bottom of the table, you might be able to get microarrays done at a DOE facility or an academic lab, but at this point, there's not commercial labs that are available to do that, but there may be in the future. And the cost range, for instance, for qPCR from $275 to $425 really represents how many potential samples you're sending them, how many different analytes do you want them to do, and so forth. Okay, so finally, in the next two slides, before I turn it over to Paul, who's going to talk about CSIA, there's a couple of key points that we want to emphasize for our audience today that we really heard from our regulators saying these are the things we're concerned about. If you decide you do want to do and use these tools at your site, here's things that you need to consider. So for example, they all said across the board, involve your regulators as early as possible, in particular if those regulators are not familiar with EMDs or have never used them in their state or sites. And they want to see a pretty detailed work plan that's going to explain, hey, what's the traditional analytical chemistry methods you're going to use, where are you going to collect those samples, and then how are you going to use EMDs to augment that traditional data. And they're going to want to see where you're going to sample, and in particular, what are your data quality objectives, because most of these are not EPA methods, for example, although the EPA has developed some qPCR methods for water quality monitoring. So for instance, they have a qPCR method that they recommend for sampling for Enterococcus or E. coli, human health pathogens in water, for instance. So they are familiar with qPCR methods, and those can be adopted for developing your water quality objectives. There's not one particular EPA method, for instance, for analyzing for dehalococcoides in groundwater. And also, the regulators wanted you to identify any permitting requirements. So Aaron will talk later about the use of biotraps, isotope-labeled biotraps in situ. And in some instances, the states are going to be concerned about you putting something down a well, so you might have to have an underground injection control permit for that. And so the key point is make sure that you involve your regulators early, have a very detailed work plan for them, and make sure that you have all the permits in place before you go forward to use these techniques. Okay, with that, I will turn it over to Paul, who will talk about CSIA and associated case studies.
Great, thanks, Jennifer. So the topic I'm going to cover is compound-specific stable isotope analysis, and this is sort of the one chemical technique that we actually looked at. Then I'll turn this over to Jim Fish in about 20 minutes, who will go through the different array of biological techniques that we also looked at as part of our ITRC group. So we'll start with a little basics and try to demystify the stable isotope analysis a bit. Basically then, so what is a stable isotope? Well, isotopes are atoms that have the same number of protons, but a different number of neutrons. So then if we look down at the lower left here, we see that for a normal carbon-12, which makes up about 99% of all the carbon in our universe, we have six protons and six neutrons. So this, you know, the six protons defines that as carbon, that's the atomic number, and if you add those two together, that's the atomic weight, fairly simple. But a very small percentage of carbon also occurs as carbon 13. Now this is a stable isotope; it won't decay with time. And really, when we're talking about stable isotope analysis, we're looking at ratios of these different types of stable isotopes. Now, what we're not talking about is carbon 14, which is a radioactive isotope. So if we look at the table in the lower right, we see that in fact many different elements have stable isotopes. like hydrogen, oxygen, carbon, so things that we might be interested in for petroleum hydrocarbons. You know, chlorine. Many of you are interested in TCE, so you can see a carbon and chlorine isotope analysis potentially. And then things like nitrogen and sulfur, which, you know, occur in various pesticides. And I'll mention that there are monotopic elements as well. People are often interested in arsenic. Now, that's monotopic, so it only has a single isotope, as does, for instance, fluorine. So you really, you know, that stable isotope analysis is not a lot of use for those elements. So why do we really care about stable isotopes or stable isotope analysis? And there are a couple different areas. These are powerful techniques for potentially forensics. So telling the difference between one source of contamination and another. And for instance, you know, different types of nitrate, something that's produced naturally versus a synthetic nitrate, or TCE that's produced in different eras or with different starting materials. And secondly, you can use this technique to document, or often to document degradation of a contaminant, either chemically or biologically, because you get a shift, a predictable shift in isotope ratios by different processes. So how are these ratios measured? What kind of instruments are used? Typically, something called an isotope ratio mass spectrometer is used. This is a little different than your normal quadrupole mass spec. These instruments are specifically designed to measure very small differences in stable isotopes. And you can do this analysis either in a bulk sample. So you could go, let's say you wanted to sample a gasoline site. You could take a bulk sample, combust it, and then you'll get a carbon isotope analysis or a hydrogen isotope analysis for the bulk sample. Now, if you separate those materials first, or the individual compounds first, you separate the benzene from the toluene, then you can look at the stable isotope ratio of, say, carbon or hydrogen in any of those different molecules, and that's why it's termed compound specific. So there's a GC step or another separation step before running the isotopic analysis. So how are these ratios reported? And this is, it's a little different terminology than many of us are used to, but essentially it's reported relative to a known standard. So you're looking at small differences or part per thousand differences, and that notation we see is called a per mil notation or a part per thousand. You're looking at differences in the ratio of the isotope in your sample compared to that in some known standard, as we see in the equation. And usually this is multiplied by 1,000 to sort of make whole units rather than decimals. But as an example, if I say, well, the delta C13 is plus 30 per mil, as we sort of see in the lower part of this slide, that means, all that means is there's a 30 part per thousand or 3% higher ratio of our carbon-13 to carbon-12 in our sample compared to a known isotopic standard. So we're just looking at ratios of these heavy to light isotopes. Now, as I mentioned, there's a standard, and for each element, there's an international standard that's generally set with a delta value of zero. You know, for chlorine, it's standard mean ocean chloride. For carbon, it's traditionally it's something called PD belemnite, which is an old carbon-containing fossil. But essentially, everything's kind of on a sliding scale. So if you run your stable isotope analysis, it can have either a positive or a negative delta value based upon whether it's either more enriched with the heavier isotope or less enriched than that known standard, which is set at zero. So here's an example of a forensic application, and this came from an EPA document. There's a nice EPA document that talks about using stable isotope analysis, and that's found, the reference to that is also found in the tech reg. But essentially, this was a PCE site, and what we're looking at here is actually a plume map, but it's flowing toward us, so it's, you know, you can kind of see a cross-section, say, of an aquifer with concentrations of PCE, but the groundwater is moving towards us out of the page. So some multi-level sampling wells were put in, a whole variety of samples were taken, and stable isotope analysis was conducted. And we see that in different zones of this plume, we get quite different stable isotope ratios, ranging from about negative 33 per mil in zone A, which then would be light, right? So that's a negative stable isotope ratio, so this is C13. So that ratio is much less than the known standard, it's zero. But then as we move across this plume in Aries C, we see that it's much heavier isotopically, so negative 25 per mil. And those are very, you know, significant differences. We see that the standard deviation or the variability in this method, in this case, is about a 0.5 per mil. And what was determined in this case was that, in fact, there were a couple of different sources that were contributing to this PCE plume. I also mentioned that this technique can be used to document degradation of a contaminant. And so what sort of happens there? Well, we have a nice graphic here, and essentially as a molecule or something, we'll use MTBE as an example. If something like MTBE is being biodegraded, you're going to get an enrichment, and a fairly predictable enrichment, depending on the process that's occurring, in the stable isotope ratio of carbon. And if we sort of look at the graphic, we have some Erlenmeyer flasks, and we have, we'll say in this case, blue molecules, and this would be MTBE that contained only carbon 12, and then we have some of these yellow, I guess, candies, which would be MTBE that also contains a carbon 13 element. And as we move to the left, from the left to the right, we see that we're getting sort of less candies overall, so degradation is occurring, and we're seeing an enrichment in the yellow compared to the blue candies. You know, this is just sort of a nice graphic of what really is occurring. So we know we're getting degradation, concentrations are decreasing, and we're getting an increase in the ratio of our carbon 13. Why does this occur? Well, it occurs because the bond strength between a carbon 13 and carbon 12 is greater than just carbon 12, carbon 12. So as bacteria or chemical processes break these bonds, there's just a fractionally slower degradation rate for the stronger, you know, the stronger bonded element. So in that case, you get this enrichment. So if we take a look at this graphically, on the x-axis, we're looking at concentration of a contaminant. On the y-axis, we're basically looking at that delta C13 value, or the carbon 13, carbon 12 ratio. What we see here are some different scenarios or different processes. Now, if we start with the blue diamonds, we see that we're seeing, as we move from right to left on the x-axis, we're seeing that the concentration is declining, but we're seeing no shift in isotopic ratio, so no difference in the carbon 13 value. What that typically means is whatever the process that's occurring is not destructive. So it may be something like dilution, it may be adsorption. It could be that you're looking at a plume and your wells are placed such that you're not really hitting the core of the plume anymore, so that you're seeing declining concentrations, but in fact it's not due to degradation. Now if we look at the other two scenarios, we'll say scenario one and two in this case, with the black diamonds we see a really strong fractionation, so we're getting a very strong isotopic enrichment as the contaminant degrades, and with the red diamonds it's somewhat less. And this could be indicative of two different degradation processes that are occurring. In one case, you get a very strong fractionation, as might be the case, say, with anaerobic degradation of TCE. You get a strong, typically you get a very significant stable isotope fractionation for carbon. Whereas perhaps the second scenario is co-metabolic or aerobic degradation of TCE, where you typically get a much less fractionation. So this can give you information not only that you're getting degradation, but it can give you some idea of the process that's occurring. And of course, you know, you should also use this in light of all the other typical geochemical and molecular tools, you know, so you really understand the conditions in the aquifer, the flow, what type of processes might be occurring. Now, I should also mention that when you see these types of reactions, it's very important to understand in the laboratory what sort of fractionation you might expect to see. And this is really important if you're going to the field and trying to make conclusions. So, you know, you can look, and for many different processes over the past 20 years, there are now literature values or literature ranges for what type of fractionation you would expect, say, with, you know, abiotic degradation of TCE with iron or certain iron minerals, or biological degradation, for instance. So a lot of those values are available. So then, summary of the benefits and limitations of CSIA. You know, this procedure can really provide direct evidence of biological or abiotic degradation. It's useful for constraining or generating some attenuation rates and also looking at mechanisms. It can allow you to identify multiple sources in some cases, and it is a commercially available technique. Some of the limitations, as I just mentioned, you need to understand the fractionation factor. So you need to know approximately, you know, what range of fractionation you would expect to see by different degradation processes. You do kind of have to plan ahead. You're going to have to take multiple samples, say along a plume or over time, and particularly to generate rates. And there are good commercial labs that do this. There are some government labs, but of course it's always beneficial to have a larger number of laboratories. So I'm going to finish up with a couple of case studies, and both of these case studies are going to discuss forensics, using CSIA for forensics. But a little later on, you know, Aaron Peacock will give some larger case studies where, you know, degradation will also be discussed in terms of using stable isotope analysis. And the first case study I'm going to go into has to do with perchlorate. Now, perchlorate sort of emerged as an environmental contaminant around the mid-1990s. And, you know, this was used as an oxidant. Those of you old enough to remember the space shuttle, and I hope for my sake most of you are, those big solid rocket boosters contain something like 380 tons of ammonium perchlorate is kind of the main oxidant. You know, it's used in rockets. It's used in some military materials. And the original paradigm when this emerged was there's really going to be very few sites that have significant perchlorate contamination. You know, manufacturing facilities, NASA sites, some sites where, you know, military rockets were produced and tested. But then a couple of things happened. Detection limits for perchlorate became much lower in the late 90s, and EPA started requiring testing under their unregulated contaminant monitoring rule in 2001. But what actually occurred was that there were a whole lot of sites that started popping up that didn't seem to be associated with any military or commercial manufacturing, and that started, you know, raising questions about other sources. You know, were there other sources besides kind of your main military and commercial sources of perchlorate? And the answer to that was yes. And one of the most interesting was a natural source of perchlorate that's found in the Atacama Desert of Chile in South America. Now, Chile, this Atacama Desert region is the driest place on Earth. It's sort of downwind of the Andes Mountains, so it gets very, very little rainfall. And over time, you have a large surface deposit of nitrate. Now, nitrate, particularly dating back to the mid-1800s, was an extremely important source of materials for both, you know, gunpowder and the war effort, as well as for fertilizer. So this material was mined, and it was shipped into the U.S. in great quantities, as we see in the figure on the right. You know, we're looking at billions of kilograms of material that were imported. Well, it turned out that this natural fertilizer contained something on the order of 0.1 to 0.3% of naturally occurring perchlorate. And this material was used widely in the United States, and it was spread over, you know, large areas. It was used a lot for citrus and other types of crops. So there was the potential for perchlorate contamination from this source. Other synthetic sources are also potentially of interest. Fireworks and flares, herbicides, chlorine bleach will form perchlorate over time. So there are a variety of different sources. But then the question is, well, you know, how could you possibly, you know, detect, say, a natural source? And I should also say that perchlorate forms naturally in the atmosphere, and you can get accumulation of material in dry environments, even in the United States. In the Southwest, there's a significant amount of naturally occurring perchlorate that's a bit different than this Chilean material. But for this, you know, for this presentation, we're going to focus on the natural Chilean perchlorate. So the one answer could be CSIA. So if you want to try and distinguish this natural from synthetic, are there potentially isotopic differences in the oxygen or chlorine that make up the perchlorate molecule? So techniques were developed with pretty good precision. There were methods developed to collect perchlorate from groundwater so you could accumulate the amounts you needed, which is a few milligrams, in order to run the isotopic analysis. And as you see in the lower right, perchlorate has, you know, there are three main isotopes of oxygen that are stable, O16, 17, and 18, and two main chlorine isotopes, Cl35 and Cl37. There's also a long-lived radioactive isotope, chlorine-36. So then, but for this to be practical, you really would have to prove initially that there are differences isotopically between synthetic forms and Chilean forms. And if we look at this figure in the lower left, we see that this is what's called a dual isotope plot. So we're looking at O18 on the x-axis and chlorine-37 on the y-axis. And if you isotopically analyze chlorine and oxygen in synthetic perchlorate, you see that you sort of get this grouping in the upper left where almost everything has a chlorine isotope ratio of around 0 per mil, very close to the standard, which is standard mean ocean chloride. But there's kind of a range in oxygen, and that has to do with the water that was used to synthetically produce the perchlorate. So perchlorate is produced electrochemically, and the source of oxygen in the perchlorate comes from water, and there are different oxygen isotope values in water. So you kind of see this range. But what's quite stark here is the difference between that and this natural Chilean material in the lower right. In particular, the Chilean material is much lighter in chlorine. As a matter of fact, it's some of the lightest naturally occurring chlorine-containing compound that's been analyzed. And also the oxygen tends to be a bit heavier. But when you plot this out in a dual isotope plot, you see that you can clearly distinguish synthetic perchlorate from this natural Chilean perchlorate isotopically. So then I'll present a brief case study where this method was used to try and understand some sources. You know, going back about 10 or 15 years, perchlorate was detected on Long Island in several different areas. A lot of different wells, as they started sampling, had low levels, you know, microgram per liter to, 10, 15, 20, 50 microgram per liter of perchlorate. And the sources were unknown. Now, Long Island has both a long agricultural history as well as an industrial history. There have been fireworks manufacturers. There are missile sites on Long Island. There's a history of production of potatoes and wineries these days and other things. So there are a number of potential sources. So for this project, sampling was done at three different locations out on Long Island. Depot Lane, which is way out on the North Fork, and if you look at the top photo, that's still heavily an agricultural, very beautiful agricultural area. As we sort of move to the south and east, the next site was a Bomark missile site in West Hampton. That's a former Bomark site. The missiles are gone. Some of the remains are there, and the Suffolk County Police Department now uses that for a training area. And then further to the west, we see the Northport wells, which were large production wells of the Suffolk County Water Authority, and we see in the lowest photo one of those different wells. Again, columns were hooked up to each of these wells, perchlorate was collected, the stable isotope analysis was done, and a lot of other parameters were also measured, your typical geochemistry, nitrogen isotopes, dissolved gases, a lot of other things to try and really understand the geochemistry. Water age dating was done to try and understand how old some of the water was that was being analyzed. And what we see when we look at the data is very interesting. Again, if we look at sort of the graphic on the left, we see that in background in these little red circles, that's our source synthetic material that I showed you previously. In the lower right, the blue boxes are that Chilean fertilizer or Chilean caliche perchlorate that was analyzed. And what we see is that two of the wells grouped perfectly with synthetic perchlorate. Those were the wells from the Bomark site. And it turns out that legacy was not from Bomark missiles, but in fact that the Suffolk County Police Department was disposing of fireworks in that area. There was also high levels of other types of elements that you'd find in fireworks. So, you know, that made a lot of sense. But for the wells on the North Fork of Depot Lane, as well as those Northport wells, isotopically, the perchlorate that was collected from those wells looked exactly like Chilean-type perchlorate. And it turns out that since this publication, there's been a number of additional publications showing very similar results from a variety of different areas, including a number of areas in California, where there's a legacy of this Chilean-type perchlorate that occurs in groundwater. And it can occur above guidance levels in some instances. So this was a really nice example, I thought, of a forensic application of stable isotope analysis. So I'll finish with one other short case study, and this relates to TCE. I'm sure many of you are interested in chlorinated solvents. And this was a New Jersey site, and essentially the question here was whether there was a single source or multiple sources of TCE that were contributing to a large plume that was detected in this location. Now here we see sort of two zones, an upper zone and a lower zone, and essentially in this upper zone, we have a well that has a really high concentration of TCE, about 390 ppm. And then we have a second well that's got about 15,000 ppm. And you can see as you kind of look at the plume map that it looks like there could be two sources here, but maybe, you know, it's a large continuous source. And on the lower right, we see that these are deeper wells. These are bedrock wells that lie directly below the upper alluvial well. So LZ1 is a well that's, you know, much deeper, but right next to UZ1. So again, you see you've got, again, high concentrations of TCE in these wells. Concentrations decline somewhat as you move down gradient. Groundwater flow is to the right here. Now, when stable isotope analysis was conducted, if we look at the UZ1 well, we were on the order of negative 38 per mil for carbon, and about negative 32 per mil for the UZ2 well. So there was a large difference. There was about a 6 per mil difference in concentrations of, isotopic values for these two different wells. And if we look at the lower part of the formation, we see that that was also consistent. So that UZ1 area and the LZ1 below it had a TCE with a similar isotopic composition, and the same for UZ2 and LZ2. Now, as we move down gradient, it looks like, you know, the isotopic range for these down gradient wells is falling in between what we see in LZ1 and LZ2. And in fact, that makes a lot of sense, because if you have sources that mix, you're going to get sort of a direct relationship in terms of mixing percentages with the stable isotope values. So this makes perfect sense if you had two different sources that were sort of moving down gradient and then commingling later on and forming a single plume. And in fact, you know, for litigation, this became very important. And it turned out with these data plus other, you know, information that was gathered, more detailed site assessment, it turned out, in fact, these were two separate sources contributing to a single plume. And again, this was, an example that was isotopically determined. And it'd be very hard to do that otherwise as conclusively as you can do here. So I'm going to end with that. And I'm going to turn this over to Jim Fish, who's then going to move into some of the molecular techniques like qPCR and several others. Jim?
Thanks, Paul. So I'm going to advance our slide here to 44. And we showed this figure earlier in the presentation. And as Paul mentioned, it depicts EMDs as either chemical or biological techniques. So I'm going to describe some of the biological EMDs, and as Jennifer mentioned, these are also commonly known as molecular biological tools, and these are circled in the lower left-hand side of the slide there. So what can these biological EMDs do for you? Well, they can provide some very specific information on biological activity, and in our case, that biological activity, what we're interested in, is the biodegradation of contaminants. I want to point out, and I'll repeat this throughout my portion of this presentation, that biological EMDs can inform you about the potential for biodegradation, or in some cases they could provide more definitive evidence that biodegradation is actually occurring. And again, I'll talk a little bit more about that distinction throughout the training. I also want to present your attention to the upper left-hand corner of the slide that shows, I can grab the arrow here, it shows some of the fundamental biomolecules that are used in these EMD methods, and we provide brief definitions of those biomolecules. And you can think of these as the targets, or in some cases, the raw ingredients of the various EMD methods that I'll be explaining. So So if we move to the next slide, these biomolecules are shown again across the top of the slide. In the middle of the slide, we show the various EMD methods that use those biomolecules. And then across the bottom of the slide, we show some of the information that's gained from those EMD methods. It also shows across with the orange arrows, across the top with the orange arrows, some of the what's called the central dogma of molecular biology, or the flow of information from the genetic code in DNA through its expression and ultimately to biological activity. So if we consider the biomolecules DNA and RNA, these are nucleic acids that encode for the production of enzymes that, or proteins that enzymatically break down contaminants. But they're also biomolecules that can give some very specific information. DNA can be used to identify microorganisms and count their numbers in an environmental sample. And we're showing here the various EMDs that use that use DNA in their methodology, qPCR, fingerprinting, FISH, stable isotope probing, and microarrays. And I'll talk more about these particular techniques later in the training. If we move to messenger RNA, the analysis of messenger RNA can give information concerning the expression of certain genes and some insight into the metabolic activity that may be occurring at your site. Excuse me. We can also assess proteins and lipids to measure activity, proteins being the biological agents that are actually involved in contaminant biodegradation. And with cell membrane lipids, we can identify major groups of organisms. We can assess the standing biomass of the microbial community, and we can also gain some insight into their metabolic activity. So the take home here is that understanding the information that any particular EMD can give you is based on the biomolecule that it analyzes. So let's move to our next slide, which is our first biological EMD, and it's called qPCR. So this is probably the most common biological EMD regulators are likely to encounter, and qPCR stands for the quantitative polymerase chain reaction. So PCR is a DNA amplification method using an enzyme called DNA polymerase. In the laboratory, it's an automated method to create many copies of a specific fragment of DNA by repeated rounds of DNA replication. In other words, the same process that happens inside of a cell to copy its DNA before the cell divides, this can be done in a test tube in the laboratory. And through this repeated rounds or cycles of DNA replication, such as shown here on our figure, the target DNA is amplified to produce millions or even billions of copies of that target DNA. And that particular target DNA could be the very genes that are involved in contaminant biodegradation. So another way to think about the PCR reaction is to think of it as the genetic photocopier in the laboratory. So quantitative PCR is a type of PCR that can relate the amplified DNA back to the numbers of copies in the original environmental sample, thus estimating the number of genes, or in some case specific organisms, that may be in that sample. Let's move on to our next slide. And we know that contaminants are biodegraded by the actions of enzymes, and many of the genes that encode for the production of those enzymes by cells are known, and they're reported in the scientific literature. So qPCR tests are commercially available for some of these known gene sequences, and we can use them to screen for degradative genes in our environmental samples. So more specifically, we can amplify those genes by the qPCR method and determine their abundance from everything else that might be in your environmental sample to get a better understanding of biodegradation at your contaminated site. So this particular slide is adapted from Appendix D in our TechReg guidance document, and it shows some of the common contaminants you may deal with at a contaminated site, as well as the target gene that encodes the functional enzyme that's involved in their degradation. Now, some of the genes that we have on here are actually what are called phylogenetic genes. Typically, that's the 16S ribosomal RNA gene of microorganisms. And this particular gene is used to infer phylogeny or phylogenetic relations and identity. Another way to think of that is it's essentially the business card gene of those microbes. While some of the other targets that are listed on this table are what are called functional genes, and these are genes that encode for a specific degradative enzyme, such as a reductase or an oxygenase. It's important to note that some genes are only present as a single copy in a cell, so sometimes enumerating genes can also give information on the number of cells or the population size in the sample, but this may not be the case for all the genes you might be interested in. So again, qPCR tests are available for known gene sequences, and we can use them to screen environmental samples for the presence and, in some cases, the abundance of these degradative genes. So moving to slide 48, just a summary of some of the benefits and limitations of qPCR. The benefits include that it not only confirms the presence, but can also determine the abundance of target microbes or their particular genes that are involved in biodegradation. And we can use this as a monitoring tool to assess changes in microbial population and growth and perhaps distribution at your site. Many of the genes or organisms associated with biodegradation are known, and qPCR tests for those genes or microbes are commercially available. As part of the limitations, it's important to recognize that the presence of a microbe or even the presence of a particular gene doesn't necessarily mean that they are active in contaminant degradation, but rather the potential for biodegradation is there. However, you could track changes in the abundance of degradative genes or microbes through time, and this could provide some strong inferential evidence that biodegradation is occurring. So that's an important distinction to make. Another limitation of this methodology is that you need to know ahead of time what you're looking for. In the case of PCR, you need to know which primer sets to add to the PCR reaction. Now, primers are short stretches of DNA that tell that polymerase enzyme where to begin the replication process, so you need to know what those are for your target gene. So if you don't know how your contaminant's degraded or what the genes are that are involved in the degradation process, then this qPCR test may not be useful to you. So as an example application of qPCR at a contaminated site, we're going to talk about a case study in our next slide here, 49. This case is profiled in our TechReg guidance document in Appendix A4. This was a site that involved a shallow aquifer in upstate New York, and it was contaminated with chlorinated solvents. A groundwater pump and treat system, as well as a soil vapor extraction system, had operated previously, but there was some effort to seek an in-situ bioremediation approach to further reduce VOC concentrations in groundwater and eventually attain site closure. The detection of chlorinated daughter products in groundwater suggested that some reductive dechlorination was occurring, but the accumulation of cis DCE and little detection of vinyl chloride or ethene suggested a classic cis DCE stall, and in this case further degradation was not really expected. Also at this particular site, there was some concern that high levels of sulfate might limit the amount of reductive dechlorination that may occur at the site. So qPCR was used to evaluate this DCE stall and help select an appropriate electron donor for groundwater remediation. And essentially, there were three distinct phases or times during which qPCR was used, and we have them as a site characterization phase, a pilot study, and eventually full-scale remedy at the site. During the site characterization phase, some additional information was required to identify the most promising groundwater remediation approach, whether that be monitored natural attenuation or some addition of a substrate to encourage reductive dechlorination. And two different substrates were examined. In this case, we're identifying them as biostimulant A or biostimulant B. And qPCR was used to identify and enumerate microbes and their genes involved in the reductive dechlorination process as stimulated by these amendment additions. It was also, qPCR was also used to enumerate methanogens, iron-reducing bacteria, and sulfate-reducing bacteria in the groundwater. Each application involved the use of a biotrap sampling device, and this is pictured here in the lower right of our slide. Some of these biotraps were amended with either biostimulant A or biostimulant B, or some were left unamended. Just briefly, a biotrap is a passive sampling device that contains beads of activated carbon, as shown in the figure. These can be deployed inside the monitoring wells at the site. The carbon inside the biotrap housing provides a surface area for bacterial colonization and biofilm development. And after these are retrieved, the DNA can be extracted from that biofilm and then used for the PCR analysis. And as was done in this particular study, these biotraps can also be amended with various substrates to promote growth and examine responses to biostimulation. There is more information about these biotrap sampling devices on our ITRC website, on the EMD website. So if we move to the next slide here, here's the results from that qPCR results from that biotrap study from three different wells. This graph is showing the qPCR results for bacteria on the left axis as cells per biotrap bead versus the various amendments or controls for three different monitoring wells across the bottom axis. The organism that we're really interested in here is D. halicocoides, the dechlorinator, and that's shown with the red vertical bars. So on the unamended or control biotraps, we see that iron and sulfate reducers, shown with the light blue bars, were typically greater in numbers than methanogens, shown with the dark blue bars. And this is consistent with the mildly reducing geochemical conditions in the groundwater aquifer. D. halicocoides populations, again shown with the red bar, were below laboratory detection limits on the unamended or the control biotraps, indicating that complete reductive dechlorination was unlikely. D. halicocoides did respond best and most consistently with biostimulant B, which is circled on each monitoring well on the graph, and it did not always respond to biostimulant A in all of the wells. So based on these qPCR results, both monitored natural attenuation and amendment with biostimulant A were eliminated as potential remediation strategies. So the next steps or the next phase was to confirm essentially confirm the results of this biotrap study with a pilot injection of biostimulant B, and this was conducted in a single monitoring well. And I'll tell you now that eventually this was followed by full-scale implementation at the site. So on our next slide, we're going to show you some results. This graph will eventually show the results from that pilot test. We're only starting at day zero just to make it easier to follow, and I'll populate this as we go along and explain it. Excuse me. So during the pilot test, biostimulant B was injected into a single monitoring well. Unamended biotrap sampling devices were deployed into that test well, and they were sacrificially sampled at discrete points in time. And qPCR was used to monitor changes in the abundance of D. halicocoides, as well as the abundance of a functional gene, in this case, a vinyl chloride reductase gene that's represented with the yellow bars on Groundwater samples were collected for VOC and geochemical analyses. So on this graph, on the left axis is the VOC concentration, and as we go through here, those will be represented with lines. And on the right axis are the qPCR results from the biotraps, again shown as beads per cell or as gene copies per bead. So if we start on the left, at day zero, this is prior to substrate addition, we see that D. halicocoides populations were on the order of 10 to the third cells per bead. The vinyl chloride reductase gene was detected, but at lower quantities than the D. halicocoides. And then this was followed by the addition of biostimulant B, and this is shown with the black vertical line. So on our next slide, we're showing some additional results. After the addition of biostimulant B, at day 105, we see that D. halicocoides actually decreased in abundance. It decreased down to about 10 of the first cells per bead. And we see that the concentration of cis DCE, shown with the blue line, it actually increases. If we move on to day 203, we see that D. halicocoides, the abundance returns back to 10 to the third cells per bead. And we also see an increase in the abundance of the vinyl chloride reductase gene. And then we see that the concentration of cis DCE begins to decrease. On day 386, the concentration of cis DCE continues to decrease. And now we start to see the concentration of vinyl chloride increasing. And this can be attributed to an increase in reductive dechlorination in the well. And this is consistent with the observation that the abundance of D. halicocoides has also seemed to increase to 10 to the 6th, between 10 to the 6th and 10 to the 7th cells per bead. And we see also a corresponding increase in its vinyl chloride reductase gene. At day 477, D. halicocoides numbers and its vinyl chloride reductase gene numbers are still maintained even as the concentration of vinyl chloride begins to decrease. So at this point, on day 492, the pilot test is done, and a decision was made to implement full-scale remediation with biostimulant B at the site. So this biostimulant B was injected into the groundwater in the source zone and in downgrading areas of the dissolved plume. And we have one more data point to show you on this graph from day 1113. Just showing that the abundance of D. halicocoides was maintained well past 1,000 days. So if we back up to day 105 and take a closer look, this is during the initial pilot study, we see that D. halicocoides decreased to 10 to the first cells per bead from its initial concentration. So why did this happen? Well, other microbes can be competitors for the available hydrogen, such as sulfate reducers and methanogens, and those populations can actually increase in response to biostimulation. In fact, the qPCR results, although they're not shown on this graph, they are shown in our Appendix A4, those qPCR results did indicate that methanogens were actually stimulated. But D. halicocoides populations did eventually respond after this a lag phase of close to 200 days here. This extended lag phase of D. halicocoides for D. halicocoides populations is a common observation at sites contaminated with chlorinated solvents where biostimulation is applied to encourage reductive dechlorination. So if we move to our next slide, I'll just quickly summarize the key results from this application of qPCR. So during the site characterization phase, qPCR results showed that D. halicocoides was essentially non-detect and complete reductive dechlorination was unlikely. It also showed that the addition of biostimulant B, or electron donor B, stimulated the growth of D. halicocoides and promoted reductive dechlorination. During the pilot study in the single monitoring wells, qPCR results showed an extended lag phase prior to being stimulated by the substrate addition. It showed the qPCR results also showed an increase, a temporary increase in methanogens, and this eventual rebound of the dehalococcoides and its vinyl chloride reductase genes, and an overall increase in reductive dechlorination was observed in the well. So during the full-scale implementation of in the remedial action, complete reductive dechlorination was observed, and qPCR results showed that dehalococcoides populations were maintained. So additional reductive dechlorination could be expected. So overall, qPCR was cost-effectively identified the best corrective action, and that action eventually led this site receiving a no further action required status. So this case study provides a good example of where EMD data was combined with the traditional site characterization data to provide multiple lines of evidence to make better site management decisions. So if we move on to our next slide, we see that we've reached our first question and answer break. And at this point, I'll turn it back over to our moderator, Juliana.
Thanks, Jim. We are going to have time for a few questions. So you're welcome to send in the questions using the Q&A pod in the lower right. I also have a question for you. So I've opened a couple poll questions. And which EMDs are you familiar with? And again, you can select all that apply here, and you're going to see the results as other people answer the questions as well. And we're going to talk in the second half of today's training about the ITRC guidance document. And so have you used the ITRC EMD guidance document? And if so, what sections have you used so far? A couple questions have come in as we've gone through the first half. Can analysis tell us whether degradation other than biodegradation is occurring?
This is Paul, and yes, CSIA analysis is actually valuable for looking at both biological and abiotic degradation. I'll say that in many cases. Again, it depends on how much those processes fractionate the isotopes or cause enrichment in the different isotopes. You know, in the case of TCE, how much enrichment you see in carbon and chlorine, which are typically measured. In some instances, you can potentially even tell differences between biological and abiotic mechanisms. In other cases, you can't, just because the fractionation is fairly similar. But yeah, that's definitely, again, there's always an exception, but in many instances, for many different compounds, that technique is useful for both biological and abiotic processes.
The next question came in about slide 29. In the last example, was testing done to see where the different sources that match the delta were located?
The answer to that was yes. MIP analysis and other sort of more traditional analyses were conducted in addition to the CSIA, and it was sort of a weight of evidence just showing that, in fact, yeah, there were two distinct sources.
Thank you. Looking at our poll results, and I should have said, if you have a scroll bar along the right of each poll question, you should scroll down to see all of the answers that are available. Which EMDs are you familiar with? It looks like we have a lot of people familiar with a wide variety, but of course the CSIA is the top winner by a little bit on the most familiar EMD. And have you used the following sections of the ITRC EMD guidance documents, the fact sheets, case studies, the tables to help select EMDs, and the decision diagrams that's going to help you identify the specific methods to answer your questions, as well as table 4-2 that's going to help you review lab reports? And most people haven't used the ITRC EM guidance document yet, so later in the second half of the training, Jennifer's going to walk us through some of these things that we have listed here, so you'll learn more about how to use the ITRC EMD guidance and quickly get to the information that you can use. We don't have any more questions right now, so we'll go ahead and continue on. We hope to have more time at the end of the class to answer questions, so you're welcome to send in questions throughout the second half of today's training. But for now, we'll continue on, and I'm going to turn it back over to Jim Fish at the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. Jim?
Great, Juliana. I'm going to advance our next slide here. Again, we see this figure showing EMDs as either chemical or biological techniques. So I'm going to continue with descriptions of the biological EMDs, again, or the molecular biological tools. I'm going to briefly describe the remaining EMDs that are profiled in our TechReg guidance document. I'm going to spend a little less time with each one and basically give an overview of the methods and highlight some of the benefits of these. And then after me, you're going to hear a case study from Aaron Peacock, who will describe some contaminated sites where multiple EMDs were used to understand contaminant degradation and not just a single EMD. I do want to just bring your attention to the fact that in Appendix D of our TechReg guidance document, we have some FAQs, or FAQs pertaining to molecular biology or microbiology terms that you may be unfamiliar with. So you, if that's the case, then maybe those FAQs will help you. Also, on our EMD TechReg website, our guidance document, we do have a glossary. So we have many terms that you may hear that are defined. So if we move on to our next slide, 57, we show a slide discussing microbial fingerprinting methods. And these are ways to understand the microbial community makeup without necessarily fully identifying to the species level. For example, microbial fingerprinting methods can identify a group of microbes that may be involved in biodegradation, such as sulfate reducers, without necessarily going to the species level. In our TechReg guidance document, we profile three different fingerprinting methods. They're abbreviated here on this slide, so I'll tell you what they are. Denaturing gradient gel electrophoresis and terminal restriction fragment length polymorphism. Both of these are methods to separate DNA. And the third is phospholipid fatty acid analysis, and this is analysis using cell membrane lipids. The figure on this slide shows the bands from a denaturing gradient gel electrophoresis, again a DNA separation method. And those bands correspond to the DNA of particular groups of microbes. And as the figure shows, we could later, if we were interested, we could identify, we could explore their identity through other methods like DNA sequencing. We could also digest DNA with restriction enzymes and get a pattern of restriction fragments that may also be characteristic of various groups of microorganisms. And another community profile or fingerprint could be generated using phospholipid fatty acids with cell membranes from the cell. In that case, because only living cells actively produce membrane lipids, we can also quantify microbial community biomass with the phospholipid fatty acid fingerprinting method. So again, all three of these methods that we profile in our TechReg guidance document generate a microbial community profile or a fingerprint, and we can use these methods as monitoring tools to follow changes in the microbial community profile, such as changes that might come about in community composition as a result of remedial action. We move to the next slide. We are showing an EMD called microarrays. Microarrays are an EMD that allow detection or tracking of a large quantity and variety of genes simultaneously. For example, hundreds or even thousands of genes at a time. And this can allow for a more comprehensive look at the microbial community all at once and basically get an idea of who's there and what they're doing. And what's shown on the left-hand portion of this figure is basically a microscope slide that has single-stranded DNA adhered to it. And that can be washed with your environmental sample. And if your sample contains complementary DNA, it'll bind and eventually fluoresce, and the whole slide can be scanned and read by a computer. There are commercially available microarrays that contain up to 100,000 genes or more, or probes to detect functional genes or groups of gene sequences that are involved in various biogeochemical reactions or biodegradation. Microarrays can also track large numbers of individual genes or organisms through time and assess changes in community structure through time. And this is what we're representing with the figure on the right as the difference between time one and time two. In addition to DNA or genes, microarrays can also be used to assess changes in gene expression by using RNA in the methodology instead of DNA. Microarrays are also customizable. There are commercially available microarrays that look at a variety of decoronating microbes, for example, that may be active at a site instead of just focusing on the well-known D. helicocoides. So it's a very versatile technique, and there are methods to make it quantitative. If we move to the next slide, 59, we're showing enzyme activity probes. Now, this methodology involves exposing your environmental media to surrogate compounds or compounds that resemble the contaminants of concern at your site. And you do this to elicit the action of degradative enzymes in the same manner that the presence of contaminants would do. When combined with a fluorescent dye, the cells will become fluorescently labeled when the enzyme reacts with the surrogate compound, and we can observe or detect enzyme activity with epifluorescence microscopy or spectrophotometry. So this method provides direct evidence of the activity of enzymes involved in the biodegradation of contaminants. So potentially it's a definitive method to demonstrate biodegradation at your site. When using microscopy, such as shown in the photomicrographs in the figure here, this method can detect and quantitatively measure enzymatic activity that can distinguish active cells or cells with active enzymes, such as those shown in the middle, the positive response. We can discriminate that from the total number of cells that may be in your sample, such as the blue cells on the left-hand side, and discriminate that still from inactive cells or the negative response shown on the far right frame. So we can also use enzyme activity probes to estimate biodegradation rates. Enzyme activity probes can be used in the laboratory, but we can also apply these at a field site using the push-pull test with the on-site monitoring wells. If we move to the next slide, we're showing another EMD that utilizes microscopy to assess the presence and activity of specific microorganisms, and this is known as fluorescence in situ hybridization, or FISH. So this method relies on the hybridization or the binding of complementary sequences of DNA or RNA, where a fluorescently labeled gene sequence as a marker or a probe is hybridized with the genetic material inside of a whole cell. And we can view this using epifluorescence microscopy. We can observe microorganisms carrying specific genes. We can determine their presence. We can determine their abundance, and in some cases, the activity of those organisms of interest. With microscopy, we can also microscopy also provides some visual information about the spatial distribution of microbes, and it can also allow for some biomass determinations. The figure that's shown here on our slide shows some photomicrographs that are taken through the same field of view in a microscope. But they're fluorescing differently based on the probes that are used to target the specific microbes. For example, the frame on the far left are Dapi-stained cells, which would be the total number of cells in your sample, whereas the other two frames are showing either methanogens, shown in red in the middle, or D. helicocoides, shown in green on the far right, based on the gene-specific probes for those particular organisms. So this is a very powerful technique for directly assessing and visually observing activity or changes in microbes of interest at your contaminated site. If we move on to our next slide, we're showing what's called stable isotope probing, or SIP. And this is another EMD method that involves the use of stable isotopes, but rather than focus on changes in the contaminant molecule like we heard from Paul, in this particular case, we're using stable isotopes as a tracer to follow the uptake or the assimilation of that stable isotope into biomolecules such as DNA or membrane lipids. So the idea is that the stable isotopes that originally came from the contaminant molecules are taken up by the cells and incorporated into their biomolecules. And we can probe those biomolecules to see if those stable isotopes are there. And in doing so, we can demonstrate that biodegradation is occurring at your site. Those stable isotopes can also be manifested as cellular degradation products such as carbon dioxide or methane. So this stable isotope probing is another method, is another definitive method to demonstrate biodegradation. So our figure is actually showing two different forms of SIP, where an environmental sample is exposed to a substrate or a contaminant that contains a known quantity of stable isotope, and that is commonly carbon-13. On the far right, we're showing a DNA SIP process where we can extract the cell's DNA and separate the heavy isotopic fraction from the lighter isotopic fraction. And we can analyze the labeled DNA by any number of methods to figure out who that DNA belongs to. The other method on the left side of the figure is showing the extraction of phospholipid fatty acids from cell membranes and analyzing them to identify the uptake of carbon-13 into membrane lipids and to identify the group of microbes that are involved in that uptake. One distinction to be aware of, phospholipid fatty acid stable isotope probing is limited in its ability to identify microbes. It's limited to identifying major groups of organisms, whereas DNA methods can identify organisms down to the species or even the isolate level. Another EMD where a rate of biodegradation can also be determined. If we move to our next slide, we're showing a variation of that stable isotope probing method, but this involves a field application and the use of passive sampling devices. And in this case, it's the same BioTrap sampling devices that I mentioned previously. In this case, we're measuring the biodegradation in situ at a field site, and in this figure, benzene biodegradation with carbon-13 is being explored. So in this figure, if you kind of move from the left to the right, carbon-13 labeled benzene is added to the carbon beads that are in that BioTrap. That sampling device is deployed in a monitoring well, and it's later retrieved, and then the analysis at the end of the diagram, there can be either DNA-based or involve the analysis of phospholipid fatty acids, as well as metabolic byproducts like CO2. So this method provides direct evidence of biodegradation of contaminants at your site, but it doesn't require any prior knowledge of the microbes or the genes or enzymes that are involved in the specific process. So it's a very powerful method to identify if biodegradation is occurring at your site, and it is commercially available. So if we move to the next slide, this is a pictorial summary of the various EMD methods that I talked about, and as well the biomolecules that those methods target. Kind of in the background of this figure is an electron micrograph of D. helicoides McCartii, the only microbe known to completely transform perchloral ethylene or trichloral ethylene to ethene. And it shows where each EMD functions and the cellular components that are targeted by those EMD methods. And those are shown with the skinny light blue arrows. It again also shows the what we call the central dogma of molecular biology, or the flow of information from DNA to RNA to protein, if you follow the black arrows inside the cell. Again, that DNA could be a phylogenetic gene, or it could be a 16S ribosomal RNA gene, or it could be a functional gene, as in this case, we're showing it as a vinyl chloride reductase gene. And we can see that there are a variety of EMDs that utilize DNA as the biomolecule in their analyses. If we follow the black arrows inside the cell, from DNA, messenger RNA is transcribed from the gene sequence. It's then translated into amino acid sequences, which become part of protein, in this case, the enzyme called vinyl chloride reductase. The black arrows outside of the cell are showing the vinyl chloride reductase enzyme reducing the contaminant vinyl chloride to ethene, and CSIA is the EMD that can measure the isotopic compositions during those transformations. So this is a good visual summary of the EMD methods that we talked about and the various cellular biomolecules that those methods are target. My last slide, slide 64, is a highlight of some of the concepts of that we call the proper application of EMDs. So the EMD team is advocating that EMDs should complement and not replace traditional site characterization data that's collected at your site. EMDs can provide information that you can't get in other ways, but it still may be necessary to have more traditional methods such as laboratory cultivation or microcosm studies to better understand biodegradation at your site. Selecting the proper EMD depends on the particular question that's being asked, and I encourage you to take a look at Table 2.3 in our TechReg guidance document that considers some of the more common questions that you may ask about contaminants at your site and the various EMD methods that can be used to answer some of those questions. And you'll see an example of this Table 2.3 later in our presentation. It's important to recognize that some EMDs can provide inferential data about biodegradation, whereas others can provide more definitive data that biodegradation is occurring at your site. And lastly, we are advocating that EMDs are best used as an additional line of evidence to supplement traditional site characterization data that's typically collected at a contaminated site. So if we move on to slide 65, I'll introduce our next speaker, Aaron Peacock, from the company Haley and Aldridge. And he's going to present two case studies where EMDs were used to better understand biodegradation at contaminated sites. Aaron?
Thanks, Jim. Hello, everybody, and congratulations for making it through to this point. So in this next section of the training, we'll be presenting a couple of case studies that involve multiple EMDs. This is a summary table in the TechReg case study appendix, and it's organized by the primary EMD that's used. The checks are for case studies covered earlier in the training during CSIA and qPCR sections, and the arrows are for the case study presented in this section and involve multiple environmental molecular diagnostics. So let's get started here. This first case study in this section was developed from work done at the Seal Beach Naval Weapons Station, and this was an ESCCP project that compared passive and active bioaugmentation. So just as a note, bioaugmentation is adding a lab-grown bacterial culture to the subsurface with the purpose of promoting growth and activity of that bacteria, whatever that bacteria may be. In this case, what we're talking about is reductive dechlorination. And then when we say by passive, the authors mean that the bioaugmentation culture was distributed via an ambient groundwater flow from injection wells located throughout the treatment area. And then in the active cell, the culture was distributed with forced advection. So if you want more information about this study, you can download it on the CERTIF website. So this slide shows the layout of the two treatment areas. The box on the left is the passive cell, and one on the right is the active cell. I want to point out on the left the well symbols. The blue hatch represents injection wells. The green hatch represents the monitoring wells. And the red circles represent the extraction wells that were used in the active cell. So we're going to be reviewing data from well PMW6 in the passive cell and AMW2 in the active cell. Now, both of these areas are marked with the yellow boxes. qPCR was the EMD used before bioaugmentation to determine if there were indigenous DHC at the site, DHC meaning dehalococcoides, and to help select a suitable inoculation culture. CSIA was used to investigate the extent of the dechlorination that had already happened in the treatment cell and before they did the bioaugmentation and then during the demonstration itself. So after the aquifer preconditioning, and what we mean by preconditioning is that there was an amendment that was added that would create reducing conditions in the subsurface and also feed the microbes. The qPCR test showed that there were native DHC or dehalococcoides on site. However, this specific population didn't contain the BCRA gene, which is needed for complete reductive dechlorination. So there are, just to back up a little bit, there's several different types or species and strains of dehalococcoides. And some have the capability to reduce thionylchloride to ethane, or ethane, excuse me, and others don't. So testing for the BCRA gene can confirm that the potential for this degradation pathway exists at the site. So if you were just to do, for example, a 16S DHC assay, that doesn't necessarily mean that you've got the actual bugs that do the vinyl chloride to ethene step. So if you want to make sure you can get that step, you should do both genes. There's also another gene called BAV1 reductase, vinyl chloride reductase. That's another vinyl chloride reductase gene if you wanted to get, you know, do even more. But essentially, this information allowed the project team to select a culture for inoculation that contained the BCRA gene and then use that biomarker to evaluate the distribution and growth of the inocula over the test cells when they did the test. One of the things here is that at this time, bioaugmentation is fairly inexpensive. So many folks, when they're thinking about doing bioremediation, especially via reductive dechlorination, the cost of the inocula at this point is not enough of a driver to make much of a difference. Just as a practical note, if you're going to be doing something like that, it's probably like $300 a well. So if you're going to do that, you might just want to consider just doing bioaugmentation as a matter of course. So here are the qPCR results from the active cell, and it shows both the absence of the BCRA gene before bioaugmentation and then shows a general increase of reductive dechlorination gene and the appearance of the BCRA gene after bioaugmentation. So also we can see in this slide how the inocula actually grew and was sustained over time as far out as they monitored, which was about 10 months. One note here is that when an aquifer is bioaugmented, there's a reliance on the bioaugmentation culture to actually grow in situ. So what we're doing when we bioaugment is we're essentially seeding the aquifer. So that's one of the reasons why you might say that folks, when they did the preconditioning, so if you were just to push the bioaugmentation culture down the well along with the substrate, and at the time the site wasn't necessarily under anaerobic conditions or things like that, you might lose some of your culture. Things are going to take a lot longer to get started, so it's better to go in with like what they did here with a precondition where they put down the material, let it stew for a while, and then add your culture. So this slide shows the qPCR results from the passive cell, and again shows both the absence of the BCRA gene before bioaugmentation, and then shows a general increase of reductive dechlorination genes in the appearance of the BCRA gene after bioaugmentation. Also, again, we can see how the inocula actually grew and was sustained over time as far out as 10 months. And a lot of the maintenance of those cultures, if you put those down, they'll stay there for quite a while. And even when you they're kind of a function of how much of the actual material, the bacterial food that's down there, how long that these cultures can remain active in the subsurface are kind of tied to that. We found essentially that a lot of the DHC, we see a lot of DHC in areas where we don't even really have any chlorinated substances, but we have a lot of organic material. That seems to be kind of their normal habitat. So these are the isotopic results from the active test cell. A couple of things here. First is that the TCE is highly fractionated. So remember, the only time that marked fractionation occurs is when a bond is broken. So we can tell right off the bat that the TCE has undergone significant degradation. The cis TCE is also more fractionated than the range of manufactured TCE, and that tells us that it's also highly degraded and also undergoing degradation currently. The sample, the same applies for vinyl chloride, and the reason it's very light at first is because it's the lightest fraction of the cis TCE that's being reductive dechlorinated to the VC. So now we can use this isotopic information to tell us how much of the original TCE has been degraded, and this is independent of the concentration. We can use this information to tell us how much TCE has been degraded. We can use it to tell us what the rate of the degradation is, and if there's been complete reductive dechlorination. And I'm doing this, I can do all this just by the isotopes and not from the chemistry. So I don't really have time to go into all that, but if you check out the guidance document, it'll give you some ideas of how all that's done. So there's a lot more here to that and to this slide than what we're just showing. Just wanted to get that out there. So these are the conclusions for the entire project, and not just what we went over in the previous slide. So essentially, the test showed that the dehalocoides was distributed similar distances from the injection point in both the active and passive treatment cells, and there was a better overall distribution throughout the passive treatment cells. Again, I don't know if that has more to be with, you know, how the bacteria grow, et cetera. But as we discussed, the CSIA results were consistent with the VOC data trend, showing significant degradation of the TCE in its metabolic products. And also, it's an orthogonal line of evidence to the VOC trends themselves. So you're kind of doubling up on, well, here's what's happening with the VOCs, here's what's happening with the CSIA. I can work out first order rate constants based on the VOCs. I can work out first order rate constants with the CSIA. I can show just with the VOC what my relative proportion of the original contaminant was. I can do the same thing with CSIA. So you can develop these parallel lines of evidence to show folks, especially not so much maybe in just the straight, you know, put material on the ground and see an active remediation, but this can also be very helpful in monitored natural attenuation and showing a regulator by multiple lines of evidence how things are happening. This second case study is the use of multiple EMDs to evaluate the potential for MNA for both TCE and 1,4-dioxane. The study was done at the Air Force Plant 44 in Tucson, Arizona. There had been a pump and treat system at the site that had operated for over 50 years, and at the time they did this study, the plume appeared to be shrinking. MNA and bioremediation were both being explored at this site, and this case study comes from a paper authored by Chang et al., published in 2012, and you can see that information for, if you want to pull that paper, at the bottom right of the slide. So this slide lists the different EMD methods that were used during this study. These methods were used sequentially so that each of the results could be employed to inform the next phase of the project. And it's important to note here that at the time of the study, CSIA, that would be just the actual compound-specific isotope analysis. We're not talking about stable isotope probing. But CSIA detection limits for 1,4-dioxane wasn't practical for low ppb concentrations, but as of now, 1,4-dioxane can be analyzed for carbon at about 1 microgram per liter, and for hydrogen at about 10 or so micrograms per liter. Now, there's some caveats with that. It depends on what the other co-contaminants are, if there's any other what we would call interfering organics, but depending upon the site, labs can get down to those levels now. The way that this was set up uses a tiered approach, and this is actually pretty, the way that I would approach it is you start with the geochemistry, you add on, then you add on the, as Jim was saying before, start with the basics and then add these things on like the microbiology, the CSIA, and the SIP. So the qPCR results showed the presence of genes associated with target contaminants present in, you know, what we would consider to be healthy numbers in all the wells. So one question you might have is that why, for example, is toluene deoxygenase, or that TOD, detected when there's no toluene? And one of the answers to this question is that the bacteria have several ways of making a living, and that bacteria or the group or groups of bacteria that carry that gene may have several types of genes that allow for them to make a living. It's not just that one gene, so it may not necessarily be active. So remember, we're talking about potential activity and not the specific activity itself. Also, many of these types of genes are ubiquitous, meaning that when you talk, they're shared genes that are across different phylotypes, and it's something that's kind of a basic thing that they can all, that a lot of them or large groups of them can do. So as Jim was saying, or as Paul were both saying, the bottom line is that there may not be a linear relationship between the presence and abundance of particular genes to a specific degradation mechanism. So that's why we need to use multiple lines of evidence. The other thing, too, is that if we're using these types of markers that may be fairly ubiquitous, we might want to consider our sampling strategy and have a background site or have a site that we know that's going to be not impacted, or so we can show a relative change in these biomarkers. The stable isotope probing results showed the incorporation of 1,4-dioxane-derived carbon into the microbial biomass. And just as a recap of this, Jim went over this really well. But what we're doing is we're taking a C13, not radio label, but a C13 labeled 1,4-dioxane. That's like putting a big red dot on the 1,4-dioxane. We're putting it on a substrate. In this sense, it's a powder-activated carbon, and we're putting it down a well, and we're inviting all the bacteria to come in and have dinner. And if they come in and they eat that 1,4-dioxane, if they metabolize it, they're either going to turn it into biomass or they're going to blow it off as CO2 or methane, for instance. Now, that big red dot, as the C13, doesn't go away. So we can then measure that big red dot as it becomes part of the bacteria. So we can measure it in the bacteria, either the phospholipids or the DNA, or we can measure it as the metabolic byproduct when they blow it off, when they breathe it out, or whatever, a CO2, carbon dioxide, or methane. So it makes it really easy for us to be able to follow this process. Now, the thing about this is there are artifacts that are introduced with these types of tests. So this, you can't necessarily use this as a quantitative test and say, well, these are what my rates are going to be for degradation in situ. However, you can say that the indigenous microbes that are there under the current conditions can degrade the contaminant at those specific concentrations. So that can be very helpful in being able maybe to get over the hump and being able to describe that, hey, we see all this stuff going away, we have these markers, let's take a look and see what's capable. So here are the results of the baseline CSIA for TCE. The fractionation effect in co-metabolism, as Paul said, is much less pronounced for TCE than, say, reductive dechlorination. So if co-metabolism is the main mechanism of degradation, then we should see the remaining TCE isotope ratio increase over time, but again, probably a lot less than we would for reductive dechlorination. Now, there's ways to use the data to show that there is complete contaminant destruction regardless of what mechanism, and I'm referring to a method called isotopic mass balance. Now, this is generally a method that uses isotopic data and a weighted average calculation to show the total amount of chlorinated ethene that's fractionated, and that fractionation is higher than the original material. And the other thing, too, is I would say, when you look at these types of data, down at the bottom, I'm looking at the del 13 C per mil, minus 25.12, minus 25.22. There's about a 3 per mil difference across that transect. Depending upon where those wells are, depending upon what the geochemistry is around those wells, I might be able to make an argument, and then how fractionated or heavy they are compared to, remember, we can start out as low as minus 32 per mil. I could almost make a case that we might be observing fractionation here at this point. In complete total terms for what the EPA says, if you want to show smoking gun that there is fractionation occurring, sure, it goes back to minus 22. But if we have co-metabolism happening, there's some other things that you can do too that would be able to show that these mechanisms are occurring. And here's the other thing. When we're dealing with the subsurface, we are never dealing with one type of system, or one type of degradation mechanism. It's always multiple mechanisms. So some of the TCE is being reductively dechlorinated. Some of the material is being perhaps co-metabolically degraded. It's the subsurface, it's dark down there, right? But it's not a monolith. So you'll have areas that are heavily reduced. You'll have areas that might be mildly reduced. You'll have areas that might be highly oxidized. You have areas where the water is running really fast. There's a lot of replenishment of, terminal electron acceptors, areas where the water is running really, very stagnant. So that's why what we're saying is you develop your conceptual site model, and a really good way to use the EMDs is to validate your conceptual site model and things that you've already had. So you end up with questions when you develop your conceptual site model. EMDs are fantastic for being able to help answer those remaining questions. So here's the result from the enzyme activity probe. And what this data shows is there was at least some current activity in each well. The take home from this slide is that enzymes are active and that biodegradation is occurring. And this is one of the few methods as far as the enzyme activity probe that shows that you have current activity at the enzyme level or at that protein or enzyme level. There's not very many, like we were saying before, there may not be a direct relationship or linear relationship between what we have with a qPCR for a piece of DNA and a degradation mechanism. That's one of the reasons why you'll see that we use a lot of benchmarking. In fact, if you go to the CERTIP's website, if you type in BioPIC and CERTIP, you'll see the latest benchmarking exercise that they published for reductive dechlorination using qPCR, regular DNA. And I think that hopefully we'll be able to pull some of that into this type of work too. But again, this slide right here just shows that you've got activity, current activity. So here are the conclusions. The qPCR test, showed that there was the presence of these genes, that they were there not just, low numbers, but they were there in some abundance. The CSIA results did not confirm TC degradation, although I think I could make a case that it might have, but it did serve as a baseline. And like we said, the fractionation will continue. So if we continue to go back over time, say if we're in an M&A situation and we've got the EPA 5-year reviews, every 5 years you go in and you have sentinel wells that you'll take and do the CSIA, you can show that, hey, we are getting continued fractionation, so we are still on our path to clean up for the site under an M&A. We had the incorporation of the 13C into the biomass. And again, as a qualitative measure, this shows that the 1,4-dioxane was being degraded under the current conditions by the bacteria that were there. And the enzyme activity probes confirmed that the enzymes were active. So the take-home here is that each of these lines of evidence are orthogonal, meaning that they're very distinct from each other. So you combine this data with a geochemistry and a good groundwater model, and you have a great set of tools for site management. And that, I think, is my time. So I'd like to turn this back over to Jennifer, if I could.
Thanks, Aaron. All right, folks, we're in the home stretch. In the last 10 minutes we have here, what I'd like to do is walk you quickly through the TechReg guidance document to show you what information is available, and highlight a couple of tools that we think are really useful to help you determine which one of these 10 or 15 tools that are available is most appropriate to answer the question I have at my site. In the next slide here on 83, we see our welcome page for the regulatory guidance document. A couple things I want to point out. We do have a search feature, so if you're looking for everywhere in this guidance document where we reference dehalococcoides and you can spell it correctly, you can use that search feature. You can also print the entire website if you wanted to, although I think there's like 400 pages of information, so I don't recommend that. On the table of contents on the left-hand side, I'm going to quickly highlight some of the information we have available on this website. In particular, we emphasize where can these EMDs actually be used for site management decisions? And we're going to compare and contrast the different strengths of these methods because we have presented a lot of them. And they can be very powerful depending on the specific question you have at your site. Then we're going to go into some more detailed description of what the particular EMDs do, give you some high-level applications for where they have been applied at different sites. And pretty importantly, we're going to give you some tools on how you actually interpret the data when you get a report back from a laboratory, some data quality considerations you want to look for in those reports. We'll give you some guidance on how to talk to your regulatory folks and stakeholders about these techniques. And then, of course, we have a whole series of case studies available. And as Jim referenced earlier, our appendices are actually there and pretty useful for you folks. If you don't have a background in isotopic chemistry or microbiology, you can go to those primers, if you will, and sort of brush up on some of these terms that we're throwing out at you. Let's think about if you are, you know, sitting at your desk and you have a half an hour lunch break and you want to figure out, well, how do I find the information that's most useful to you? We have broken out some of the topics on our website based off of what your particular area of work is. So if you're a regulator, we give you a suggested reading list. Versus a consultant or a stakeholder, for instance. On slide 86, we highlight one of the tables that was referenced earlier in this presentation today, table 2.1, which we think will be pretty useful. One of the issues is how do these EMDs complement my conventional data, right? So on the left-hand side of this table, we say maybe you're doing remediation and you're evaluating your concentration trends in your mass discharge of contaminants, but it doesn't actually tell you what the degradation mechanism is or how quickly things are occurring. One of the potential data gaps is really a limited ability to optimize remedy. I put a lot of biostimulant down the well, but I don't know how my microorganisms of interest are responding to that. So EMDs would allow for more accurate evaluation of how microorganisms, for instance, are responding to that biostimulation. On slide 87, we see table 2.2, where we're comparing and contrasting these different EMDs, right? We're giving you the potential benefits and limitations of some of these, and we also recommend some other EMDs that might be complementary to that one particular tool. So, for example, qPCR, one of the advantages is it tells you if that particular microorganism is present at the site. Well, presence of a microorganism doesn't actually mean there's doing the degradation that you're interested in. They may just be hanging out because conditions aren't exactly optimal for them to degrade your contaminant. So qPCR does not confirm activity, it just tells you potential. So you might partner the qPCR with compound-specific isotope analysis or do a variation on qPCR, which is called RT-qPCR, where you're actually looking for expression of the genes associated with degradation. On slide 88, we see table 2.3, where we're giving you another comparison of the EMDs, and we're ranking these based off of particular questions you might ask during different phases of remedial activity. So, for instance, during site characterization, one of your first questions might be, are the microorganisms that I'm interested in actually present at my site? And we highlight in this table the particular tools that could be used to answer that question. Or you might be saying, hey, is biodegradation occurring? What tools can I use to answer that? Now we recognize there are a lot of X's checked in this table, right? So now I've got are contaminant-degrading organisms present? Well, I can use qPCR, RT-qPCR, microarrays, et cetera. So how do you actually figure out which one to use or find a vendor to ask for a quote? If we go on to slide 89, we've presented you with some decision diagrams to try to narrow down which technique is probably most appropriate for your site. And again, we present this as a series of questions. Let's assume you're doing site characterization. You want to determine, are contaminant-degrading microorganisms active at my site? Not only are they there, but are they doing what I'm interested in them doing? And so let's assume that you actually want to count the number of organisms or functional groups. The first question is, hey, is there even a qPCR analysis available for this particular compound? Let's say you've got a novel contaminant and you don't know where the state of the science is. You can ask a commercial lab if they've got a technique for it, or you can do a little digging in the literature and determine, has anyone even published a technique for it that may not have been adopted commercially yet? If yes, there is a method available, then you can consider RT-qPCR. If there's not a method available by qPCR, perhaps fluorescent in situ hybridization or FISH methods have been developed, and you can look at those kind of techniques. We also highlight in these decision diagrams those techniques that we consider to be commercially available. And so, for instance, CSIA in this table on the lower right is highlighted in red because that is the one that is easiest to find a vendor to do the analysis. On slide 90, I'm just going to pretty quickly go through what kind of information you might find as we drill down into the particular techniques on the TechReg guidance document. So we're going to use, for example, on slide 91, qPCR. Here you see the kind of information we provide about that technique. Of particular interest is some of these applications for the technique. So for example, let's go, slide 92, table 4.1, we see example applications of qPCR. Now, some of these applications are things that are discussed in our case studies, but some of them are not. And so you might find a particular compound on this table that is similar to your site, or you may be at a similar project lifecycle stage at your site. And so this table will help you determine, hey, yeah, maybe I should consider that particular technique. So here, for example, in case study A5 in California, qPCR was used. They were in the monitoring part of the life cycle, and they were looking at chlorinated solvents, and the EMDs they used was qPCR and CSIA. On slide 93, we give you some tools on how to interpret the data. So, for example, let's assume you're doing site characterization and your question is, are the contaminant degrading organisms present at my site? It's chlorinated solvents, and so you say, I've got to determine if D. halococcoides is present at my site. And so you go and ask a commercial laboratory to test a water or a sediment sample for D. halococcoides 16S rRNA genes. And the result you get back from the lab says, okay, you've got greater than 2 times 10 to the 6th gene copies of 16S rRNA or D. halococcoides gene copies per liter of water, for example. And the question is, well, what does that mean in terms of biodegradation at my site? And so we know pretty well from a lot of experiments and field observations that if we got that minimum threshold of 2 times 10 to the minus 6 gene copies of D. halococcoides per liter of water, you can expect that dechlorination is occurring at your site. You, as Aaron alluded to, probably want to look for some of the specific degradation genes, VCRA or others, to determine if the complete dechlorination to ethene is occurring at your site. On slide 94, we give you a list of information you probably want to look for in your data report from the commercial laboratory. So similar to what you would find in a GC report from a lab, you want to look for reporting limits, which might be gene copies per liter or mass of sample. You also want to look for laboratory control samples. So we want to see DNA extraction controls and qPCR positive and negatives reported from the laboratory and number of replicate analyses that they performed. On slide 95, we talk about some things to look at in terms of EMD data quality. Now remember, these techniques are not EPA certified at this point. But if you're looking for this type of information in your QA/QC and in writing your laboratory, or I'm sorry, your field sampling protocol, you're probably going to get good quality data. So we give you some guidance here in this section 10 of the guidance document about things to include. So for instance, frequency and location of samples are going to be collected at the site. Are you going to do active versus passive sampling? Are you going to put something down your well and allow the microbes to colonize that, or are you going to be actively pumping? And what is the effect of that type of sampling on your results, in particular with respect to microorganisms? We give you some guidance on aseptic sampling and how to train your field crew to not basically contaminate your samples biologically. And we also report on some known biases or issues with these techniques. While they're very powerful, they don't apply in all situations. And so with that, I wanted to thank the audience for your attention today. And hopefully at this point, we have, or you can walk away and be able to describe the utility of these EMDs to your particular site and be able to define when these EMDs can cost effectively augment your traditional data sets. And with that, I will turn it back over to Juliana.
Thanks, Jennifer. We are going to have time for questions, so you're welcome to send those in using that Q&A box in the lower right. We also have a link to our and I also have a poll question that I'm going to ask you, so I'm going to open those as well. Would you recommend using EMDs after hearing today's class? And also thinking about projects that you're working on, in the next 6 months, how could you use this ITRC guidance? So you're welcome to answer both questions, and again, we have those set to broadcast so you can see what other people are saying. On our final page, we include a link to our feedback form. We do look for everyone on the call today to fill out the feedback. We really do use the information that you provide, and we appreciate you taking just a few minutes to give us your feedback. One of the features available through the feedback form only at this point is to create a participation certificate. So at the bottom of that feedback form, there's a box that you can check to certify that you attended today. If you check that box, the next page is going to have that participation certificate available for you. You can download the PDF. If you included your email in the feedback form, it's going to also send you an email with that certificate. So if you are interested, please be sure to check the box at the bottom of the page. Right now, this is the only way for you to get that certificate, by completing the feedback form and checking the box at the bottom. We also have some links to additional resources if you're interested. Those are available through a link here on this page. For our phone line participants, if you'd like to, you're welcome to jump in with a question. It's #6 to unmute your phone, and you can jump in anytime with a question. We have a couple questions that have come in, and our trainers have answered these questions online, but I want to go ahead and ask them and ask the trainers to answer on the line so that everyone can hear the answers. How do you distinguish between isotope enrichment between different sources from the enrichment that occurs from biodegradation?
This is Paul. I can handle that. There are different ways to do that, and I would say that the first thing you have to look at is whether those sources, first of all, could have ever commingled. If you're looking at different sources, you want to get sort of up in the definitive source area. If this is sort of a traditional plume, or maybe you have a NAPL or whatever. And you want to look at, are the chemical conditions, are the geochemical conditions such that you might expect biodegradation? So do you have anaerobic conditions? Do you have carbon substrates? You know, what are your EMDs showing you? So first of all, can you document that the geochemical conditions and the molecular conditions are such that you might see degradation? And then secondly, if you look in those source areas, if you have sources that should not have commingled, that's another answer. Some of that is just practical, traditional site assessment work. And another factor, if you have NAPLs, the dissolve phase very close to a NAPL often maintains the characteristic of that NAPL, even if there is some degradation going on, because you have enough partitioning from the NAPL back into the dissolve phase that sort of overcomes any amount of biodegradation, any effects it would have on fractionating isotopes. Um, So yes, that can be a complex scenario, and it's potentially there could be confusion there between degradation and two different sources. But if you also use all your kind of traditional site assessment tools, I think a lot of times you can weed that out just by looking at a lot of different lines of evidence. Aaron, I don't know if you had anything else, any other thoughts about that?
And Aaron, you may need to unmute if you are muted.
Am I unmuted?
You are now.
Great. I was just agreeing emphatically with Paul. So.
Thank you. Which bacteria were found to degrade the dioxin?
Well, what I said, if people want to get a better idea of that, there's a I don't know if it's complete. Yeah, there's a final report on that already, biodegradation of 1,4-dioxane. It's CERTIF report ER-1422. So if you go to the CERTIF website, you can download that. And they talk about different types like pseudomocardia, a strain of pseudomocardia, a strain of rhodococcus. And then there's, like we showed in the training today, there's different types of functional genes that we can look at, that Todd gene, soluble methane monooxygenase, SMMO, to look at broader evidence for degradation. One of the things is that a lot of work has been being done now with propanotrophs, so propane. So there might be some genes that we can pull from propane oxidation that might be more specific than just soluble methane monooxygenase. So that's one thing is I'm aware of a site where they're putting in propane, they're seeing fractionation of the 1,4-dioxane, they see that it's going away rapidly, and a lot of the bacterial biomarkers that they're using to monitor this process are not showing anything. So it shows that there's still a lot for us to learn out there. And that's why it's really important that we have these different lines of evidence, our straight geochemistry, our straight contaminant chemistry, perhaps our CSIA, and then our micro, because we've only described, less than, 3% of all the microbial activity that's out there. So I don't want to throw them under the bus without knowing 97% of what's there. So that's why it's important to do all of this together.
Are there any confounding effects with MTBs caused by the vast biodiversity of microbiota in the subsurface?
So this is Jennifer, and I can take a stab at that. Maybe Jim can jump in. It depends on the technique you're applying. So if you're doing a microarray, for example, you're going to be able to look at a lot of the biodiversity in situ. For instance, the phylochip or the geochip are commercially available and help you determine not only who's present at the site, but in some instances, what kind of, are there a bunch of iron-reducing organisms or sulfate-reducing organisms present at the site. Some of the techniques that are very specific for instance, a degradation gene, we have a qPCR assay for that. And the number you get back from a commercial laboratory is very specific to that one particular gene. Now, that doesn't mean that all of our qPCR techniques are perfect. In particular, some of the more novel techniques that are newly developed, if there hasn't been a very good QA/QC done in the development of that technique and you adopt a very new one and ask a new commercial laboratory to do it for you, I would interpret some of those results with caution. Make sure that you have a good sampling inside your plume and sampling outside your plume where you'd expect that particular gene to be turned on or not on if there's no contaminant present. So with some of the more established techniques, we feel pretty confident in the results. If you're using a new compound or a novel technique, I would have an expert available to help you interpret some of those results.
Thank you. We don't have any more questions, and we're about out of time, so we'll go ahead and wrap up. I'd like to thank our trainers and our participants for joining us today. If you haven't already, please fill out that feedback form. We really do use the information that you provide. We're always working on new training classes, and your feedback is something that we use to help trainers of those new classes as well as improve this current training class. More information about ITRC is on the website, which is www.itrcweb.org. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great day.